So yesterday we talked a bit about samvega, the urgency where we face personal and social and regional and global crisis, major kind of real collapse in the kind of world that we have lived in and that we are used to and that we value. And you really feel there is a collapse of that world and that we need to respond with wisdom and not collapse with it or collapse under it. So today I want to explore where do we find, how do we find and meet the big self that we are, instead of getting swept away in a contracted place under the change and the difficulty, and how not to go to pieces when everything else is going to pieces. How not to go to pieces with it. But and yet experience it. It's not about making a wall between us and the pain of the world. The Buddhist teaching doesn't go there at all. It goes the opposite place, which is really to feel the pain of the world, but to be able to hold it and actually to offer something and contribute. So, and yesterday we brought up in the also the refuge in our kind of hidden Buddha, and this place being, shall we say, the highest place we can be. And doesn't need to be called Buddha, but it's the, shall we say, the, again, the big self that we all are. But we forget it. And so I want to kind of explore practice, ways of practicing to remember our big self. A lot of these kind of ways, and I was talking about it with my wife, Rachel, who's really into this subject, but the way she looks at things, and she gave me some nice words in Hebrew, about that remembering our big self needs to happen sometimes akifin. That's one of the way she described it. It's not direct. You can't say, I want to be a free Buddha person. Okay, where? How? But if you do, you know, if you do something right, it happens. And you notice it all of a sudden. And it can be hidden. And it's a little bit like looking for underground water. The water under the surface of the earth. Well, we see the tap. We open the tap. Or we see rain. But under the ground, that's where the water is. That's our source. And so it's really touching the sources, and the makorot, the sources inside us. But they're not so easy. You can't say them directly. And often very small things in life do it for us. And we realize that we're bigger than we thought. And so the first thing I want to say is not to we tend to put working with consciousness and working with our inner world up here. But in the spiritual life, and I think it doesn't matter which one, can be Dharma, can be something else, the world of action, the world of ethics, the world of small things, the world of how we cook and how we garden and how we look after our bodies, our families, our children, our society, actions. A Dharma teacher I know, the beginning in October, every day, all day, he was going, making sandwiches for soldiers. He said, that's my mission. I don't know if it's good, not good, or whatever. That's where I'm every day, all day, hundreds and thousands of sandwiches. We do need to pay attention and say the first, to give full importance to how we are in the world. Not just how is our consciousness. If we do lots of meditation, then we'll find our big soul. Yes, but also the world is also rebounding. There's ricochet. So we need to sow the seeds of benefit and wholesome. And it will feed back on us. That's the importance of ethics. It's ethics is crucial. It doesn't work without it. We can meditate, meditate, meditate endlessly, but if there's real ethical issues, if we're making a mess in the world, it will drag us down. So actions are one external place that can help to show us our big self. I remember watching an amazing movie, one of the best Buddhist movies I ever saw. It's called Why Did Bodhidharma Go to the East, I think. And there was beautiful hermitage, not really a monastery, a small country hermitage, small monastery of monks in Korea. They didn't meditate. They're Buddhist monks, Zen style, no meditation at all. All day, growing vegetables, collecting wood, cooking, making fires, cleaning, and so on. And their practice was doing all of that, but having in the background a question, which is an existential question. That was just working in the background as they were acting. There is the monastery story that I like. The students asked the Zen master, what's the highest thing you can do? He said, to sit in meditation. So they said, yeah, but I never see you sitting in meditation 1 minute. You're gardening, you're cleaning, you're cooking, you're helping guests coming, you're doing the books, the money. And I never see you sitting in meditation. He said, yes, I receive guests, I clean, I cook, I do the books of the monastery, but I never stop sitting in meditation. So we need to have to see the importance of that and to remember it. The kitchen. Who's here cooking? Yeah. There's a very nice, who else wanna? No, just you. There's a very nice Indian yogic expression that the kitchen is the place of karmic acceleration. Maids karmi is where karma really, really gets going. With all the dramas and the challenges, that's why the heads of monasteries in Zen are always coming from the kitchen. Kitchen boys become the head of the monastery.
Mixing the tahini.
But it's been it's really been very important in our life, my own life. And, you know, when I leave this framework of being in the role of a teacher, then I'm in the role of a gardener in my garden, or I'm also cooking and cleaning, and I forget teaching. I'm not a teacher. I'm a gardener. And our olive trees and my chickens, and I'm there with all of that. And it's kind of, but it's really important to have as much as possible for all of us harmonious, simple actions in life that remind us of some basis of the underground water, the water under the earth, the sources of. So do that in life. Remember the way you grow your potted plants in your house, in your flat. Doesn't matter where you are. You don't need to be in Clue. You can be in Tel Aviv. But the way you are with your animals, with yourselves, with your food, with your plants, with your, you know, it just helps on the level of, and of course the ethics. And the reason it helps is because it acts as a weight, an opposite weight to the story. That what takes us away from our big self is getting stuck in stories. Dramas, stories, issues, media. Not that that's a problem, to know what's going on is not a problem. But the problem is to be drowned in it. And so the stories take up so much space in the consciousness that there's nothing left. There's no space left to meet our big soul because the stories are overwhelming. I look at the news every day, and why not? Just like you look at the weather, why not? But the stories don't need to take over all the inner space in our consciousness. So circumstances are there. Circumstances are external circumstances, nesibot, are there. They're influencing us. But we do need to have other places so that they don't take us over completely. And a beneficial connection to life is one place. Meditation world, of course, helps hugely. And here I think it's worth remembering the kind of basis of what we do when we meditate. What's the point of it? The basis is to develop a skill, miumanut, a skill in the three characteristics. The three seals, which are dukkha, anicca, anatta. Meditation gets us closer to reality rather than being, as I say, wrapped and covered in stories and conditioning. And closer to reality is the three characteristics. So the first thing to do is to understand is that when we feel small, contracted, mekuvatz, because of story, because of issues, because of pain, because of disasters in the world, or because of close people in the family, because of all kinds, you know, the people here in this room who have husbands, partners that are serving in Miluim, in this room, I won't say who, maybe more than one, people I don't know, or people who have lost close people. So of course it's a lot of potential to feel down and contracted. And we can't ignore that. But the first thing is to know pain as pain. Dukkha is dukkha. The contracted place to feel when we are contracted, when we feel small and under and limited, is to know that and to allow it. Say, this is the name of the game called dukkha. And give it its name and see it clearly. And if we're under the stories, if we feel taken over by stories, the first thing is, it doesn't feel good. It feels lost. I don't feel myself. I feel I'm just stories. And I'm just taken over. They feel very real, but one way, the first thing that is really important is to see it as painful. That when we feel contracted, okay, I feel contracted. Not to deny it, not to pretend it's not happening. I feel small, I feel contracted, I feel under, I feel lost, I feel confused, I feel helpless. Okay, give it its name, dukkha. Ah, okay. It's already taking it into a little less personal place. Dukkha is because of being born in a body. It's not my fault. One of the gifts of dukkha as the first of the three characteristics is that it helps us not to take it personally. Suffering, we don't need to take it so personally. It's part of samsara, it's part of being born in a body. Don't have to take it personally. Okay, we do take it personally, but we can remember, if it's dukkha, it's a little bit of a help. I don't have to take everything so personally. It's the name of the game of being born in a body, and every ant and every insect and every cat and dog and human being is in the same place. Born in a body, it will happen, dukkha. Can't avoid it. So we do need to be without blaming ourselves for feeling contracted, but to see it as dukkha. It's all right to feel contracted, to feel down, to feel lost, to feel helpless. It's all right. It's being a person. It's okay. We don't need to add to it, oh, I should be a Buddha. I should be better than this. I shouldn't be in this. No, we don't need that. It is what is. And so there's a kindness there which is important. The whole of the practice has in it kindness. And I won't go into this now, but the kind of awareness that the Buddha taught, and he said, this is what took me to awakening, is called yoniso manasikaram. And yoniso manasikaram is a wisdom or awareness that is female, that is about receiving, that is bearing fruit, that is like a womb. It gives birth. It's not theoretical, analytic, distant, etc. It's more female, more receptive, more heart. Binata lev, it's more heart. So yoniso manasikaram is very important. Form of awareness, and that's what we develop in meditation. So the other two of the three characteristics is anicca anatta, and clearly that's crucial. The insight that stories and issues that take us over, they come and go. And they don't in the end really belong to us. We apply ownership to them. We say it's me, I am suffering, I have this, I've got a difficulty which is there in me. But slowly, slowly, through kind of clarity, we see, well, it's something that comes and goes. It gets stuck in us, but it actually is coming and going like a cloud. And it doesn't need to be believed totally. It doesn't need to be owned totally or believed totally. You say, well, I have to believe it. It's happening, no? This thing, it's happening, it's there. Yes, but how much of it we need to take it on as me, and how much of it we need to think as real and solid, believing it. How much do we need to believe? Byron Katie had this lovely expression, just, is it really so? Ze bemet kacha? I think, beautiful Dharma language. If we just, you know, go home with that, every time we jumps up a story that gives us trouble, bemet kacha? Is it really so? The inquiry opens that. And a lot of work with thinking will help with help with this. This is why the practice, meditation practice, needs to have quite a lot of time with citta, with mind and heart, not just with body. Body is crucial, but we have to go to mind and heart and see thought, which carries story and memory and belief, and see thought as like a Tibetan image, like a thief, ganav, a thief coming into an empty house. There's nothing to steal, so the thief just has to go away. Nothing to do here. You can see our thoughts a little bit like that. Thoughts arrive, nothing to do here. Okay, bye-bye. This is very much needed. We need to pay a lot of attention to our emotional life. Citta is not only thought, it's also feeling. And our feeling life, it drives us so powerfully, and we often don't notice how it's driving us. Feelings such as anger or fear or anxiety, they drive our life in ways that we often don't see, because they generate story. So, for example, the fear of the other will make war. Where the war and the violence is actually coming from the fear, very often, most wars in the world coming from fear, because no one wants fear, so they want to shut down the fear. So they want to say, I want to be secure. I want to feel security and not fear. So they go to war. But they go to war in order to shut up the fear. I won't talk about now because it's too hot, but even a war, an unbelievable catastrophic war, for example, the First World War, with millions of soldiers dying horribly, it was all fought because of fear, because some German generals felt that the French were getting too strong, so we have to stop them before they get stronger. It was fear of what might happen. And then the devastating war. And most wars actually fought to try and shut up fears rather than because they're really, not always, of course, I'm not generalized. There's sometimes, you know, it's not that, but I'm just saying that should be aware of the stories that our emotion create. And then we live with those stories and we forget that the emotion made those stories. A story of a victim, which is so much in the history of Jewish people. It's a story coming from emotion. And then we live with it and we're under it and it makes lots of suffering. And But it's a story, it's a kind of a view of reality, and we forget that the emotion creates it, and then we just live with the view of reality, and we forget the emotion that made it. So really you need to give space to emotions. They are part of our nature. They are our responses to life. They're beautiful. All emotions based on are basically love. Every emotion is basically grounded in love, because emotions are our relationship to and responses to the world. It's how we respond. So if we have a lot of self, then it turns to anger, not love. So we have protection. But love with a lot of protection becomes anger. A lot of sense of shield. But underneath, anger is relationship. We are trying to, we're in relationship, we see another, we feel another, and we feel threatened by another, so we go into anger. But it's still connection. So emotions are really okay, but we just need to give them space, give them room, see that they come and go like a thought. They're also made of nothing in the end. And we just do need to see them with wisdom, with the three characteristics, really important. But not to deny them, and not to say we shouldn't have emotion, but celebrate emotion. Beautiful image of Lama Tilman. How an emotion is like a jewel in the mouth of a snake. And if you catch it, like anger, if you catch it right at the beginning, the snake won't bite you, and it becomes a jewel. In other words, it becomes something that will help you. If you really catch the emotion, it's a power. And it can help us. It can give us power. This is Tantra. This is Tantric teaching. So it's worth remembering that our practice, not only three characteristics, but our practice also builds a certain qualities of life which we need when we're faced with difficulty. We need meditation in order to find our ground when we are constantly challenged by the world around us going to pieces. So we need qualities. We need to be steady. We need to be loving. We need to be compassionate. And we can't invent these qualities because they're pitom. We need to see them and develop them, and mindfulness does it. Mindfulness, like the Buddha said, be an island to yourself. In other words, stand steady like an island in the middle of stormy seas of change. How you do that? Seeing the breath, seeing a thought. A breath is a breath, an emotion is emotion, a thought is a thought, a feeling is a feeling, a story is a story. Seeing things as they are, you say, okay, I'm back in the truth of things, life, back in life. And from there we get steady. So it's very much grows in us over years of practice. We develop qualities of being that will help us deal with difficulty, major difficulty, including our own and other people's death. It works. Meditation and spiritual life work. It's not just a theoretical kind of entertainment. It works. It builds a way of looking at reality. It builds qualities in us, builds powers in us. And it gives us something, like we said yesterday, the refuge, that nobody can take away from us. Nobody can take away. There's, you know, Viktor Frankl talked about it with his wisdom. There's things that nobody can take away from us. And that would be presence, That will be steadiness, that will be awareness. Nobody can take that away. Our awareness grows, and then it begins to be more active in life. And we live from awareness more and more as we practice over years. That's why I keep going to retreats. No, keep going. Keep doing retreats and more and more and more. And, you know, no problem, no limit. Because we grow another being in us. We develop powers and potentials and capacities steadily through presence. And gradually we look at the world from the place of awareness and not from a place, less from a place of stories and issues. It's awareness looking out of our eyes. That happens slowly over time. But it changes the way we are in life, gives us another potential. So one more piece that I want to discuss, which is in the Dharma is not a sort of practice for feeling better. Behind everything we've been saying, Lido and myself, there is very much a big picture. The refuge, for example, is a big picture. So when we're faced with a situation like war today, how does the big picture help us to remember our big soul, our big person that we are? So there is definitely teachings in the karma, in the Dharma, and I'm going to mention karma next. But there is definitely teachings that can really help us to give even consolation, even a sense of being supported and having consolation of in the middle of tragedy and difficulty. And yes, karma is one of those places. And karma can really help us. Understanding of karma, it's a big story. Again, you know, I don't want to go into it too deeply now. But karma can help us as a way of looking at reality in which we have less control. If we think we have an illusion of control, it'll only give us trouble. But if we feel that karma is doing its thing, I can't control reality. I'm not God. I am made by reality. I can't control reality. So you say, well, wait a minute, but especially in the Western world, India is very good at this. Maybe too much. Maybe they go too far. And they say, okay, let it all happen, man. I remember waiting on a train platform for 14 hours. 14 hours waiting for a train that was 14 hours late in India, in Varanasi in 1976. Whenever. And we were sitting on the platform with all the people there giving each other massage on their heads and making chapatis. It's karma, you know? The train will come one day. So India maybe takes it too far, but the West, we take it too far the other direction. We really take too far this illusion of control. And then it gives us a lot of headaches. The Bhagavad Gita, It's really a book for us for today. There were two armies facing each other with relatives on both sides. Arjuna asking, how can I kill my brothers, my cousins on the other side? How did this happen? And Krishna coming with a very difficult message. It's not in your hands. What happened, happened. Life made it like that, that there's two armies and there's relatives on two sides fighting each other. I see it now. When I go to my neighbors in Sheikh Tanun, next to Klil, and they tell me that their brothers and sisters are in Lebanon, their cousins and their relatives are in Lebanon, and they're here, and they're frightened for them, and they're it's happening now. So Krishna said, look, you're not in charge, you're not in control, this happened. And the only thing you can do is let go and do the best you can in life, but not be under illusion that things should be something else. This is what happened. The Buddha said more than once, he managed to stop wars, but he didn't stop all wars. And the most devastating war at his time was when a neighboring king massacred, killed all his people, the way he came from. And the Sakyans, they were all killed, and women and children. You know. And the monk said, why, you can't stop this? He said, no, it's too strong. Karma is too strong, I can't stop this one. He managed to stop others, but he said, I can't. So we feel it, honestly, today, we feel it. Who didn't feel when Trump was elected 2 days ago? Who of us didn't feel somewhere deep down, I lost control, something happening beyond my control here? I'm sure half of America feels the same. How did such a thing happen? Because we're not in charge of karma. And we do, if we are obsessed with our power to make change, we're in control. It's self again. I have to be in control of things. It gives us a lot of pain. Instead of that, we discover we do have power, but it's power to create waves in the world and then let go, which is not the same as control. So every word I'm saying now goes out into the world. Every thought that you're having goes out in the world. Everything you do goes out in the world. But you have to let go and say karma does what it wants. Life does what it wants with I do the best I can. I will create the best conditions. Nothing is lost. That's the positive side of karma. Nothing is lost. And so the quality of our actions and our speech and so on in the world does do something. But if we're in sense of pressure to control, we got problems. So that's one place which I think can, in a way, the nechama in the situation that we're in here, in the middle of suffering and war, it can give nechama. I will do the best to stop it, but I'm not in control. And there really is, in the Dharma, other places, the big picture can really help us in many different ways. And if we take things less personally, there isn't evil. There's no word for evil in all the Buddhist texts. But there's plenty of words for ignorance. Borut Ein Sof. Endless Borut. It's part of the universe. Ignorance is part of the universe. But no, but the good and evil not really there in the Dharma. But I really enjoy that quote from Shakespeare. He said in Hamlet, There is no good or evil. It's thinking that makes it so. Mm-hmm. It's not existing in the world. It isn't good or evil in life. Life is just life. We can't say good or evil in life. We can say it personally. This is painful and this is not painful. But life, we can't say that. It doesn't exist, good and evil. So it is helpful to us to kind of keep that big picture. The big picture that life is bigger than our view of it and our sense of control. Causes and conditions are endless. You know that story, the Tibetan story of the two people in the marketplace. I've said it before, so maybe you know it already, but a story I like. Two people in the marketplace, and one got hit by a stick. And he started to shout at the stick. And his friend said, wait a minute, wait a minute. Why are you shouting at the stick? Why not shout at the hand that holds the stick that hit you? He said, oh yeah, okay, sure. So he started to shout at the hand. And then his friend said, look, the hand belongs to a person. So you shout at the person that hit you, not the hand. He said, oh yeah, okay. And he started to shout at the person. And then his friend said, wait a minute. The person hit you, you don't know why. Maybe he hasn't eaten for 3 days. Maybe he's angry about something. Maybe he just, you don't know the conditions that made him hit you. So you have to shout at the conditions that made him hit you. His friend said, yeah, okay. He started to shout and he said, but wait a minute. That means shouting at the whole universe, because the whole universe conditions made him. Where did it stop? What's the conditions? Where's the end of the thing? It's endless, the conditions that made this event happen. So I have to shout at the whole universe. How can I do that? His friend said, yes, you see, exactly. The conditions, the causes and conditions that made this moment what it is, right now, all of us sitting here, one person speaking, other people listening, each one sitting, each one thinking, each one, you know, moving their hands or their feet. This moment needs the whole universe to make it like it is. It's a big story. But it can give us some nechama, that this picture is bigger than my pressure to control something that is unpleasant and difficult. So, how to kind of, and the last bit, how to experience and live with that big picture, how to really hold that big picture. It needs us to experience the bigness of things in consciousness. It needs us to have a taste of the unlimited, of something beyond the limits of the self and the world, the duality of me and the world. We need to experience again and again something which is unlimited, which is beyond it, which is really beyond thinking, beyond concepts, beyond hamsaga, beyond it's something, and it's not sort of beyond us. I think we all have it. We all know what I'm talking about. We all know stars in the sky. We all do have that. Somewhere in our soul, that taste of it, of something beyond the limited world of me and the world. And I just want to give you encouragement not to have to work it all out and to have kazeh maskamot, conclusions too quickly. It's fine to be in a world of not knowing, because not knowing, idea, not having a thought about things, but to go beyond the thought, goes to wisdom. The wisdom is often, I don't know the answer. I don't have a conclusion. I don't have to know the answer to everything. I don't have to have all that knowledge. I want to go to wisdom. Wisdom is always beyond what the ordinary mind can touch. I have here I have 300 posts in Instagram, which is amazing. It's actually your encouragement, Liron. But one of them I just found, one that came before, and I just found it and I brought it with me just because it's about this. It's about, and each one has a picture and some phrase and some explanation from me. So do look up my Instagram. There's 300 posts. They're amazing. So this is just one of them. And it has a picture. You can't see it from here, but it has a picture of a path in the middle of the nature. And they're all with the pitgamim of one sentence, and in English, aphorism. And this particular one says, the mind cannot know what is beyond itself. Go there. The mind cannot know what's beyond itself. Go there. And then the explanation that I wrote says, we have an unbelievable mind. It has vast possibilities of knowledge. I have an Oxford English Dictionary in my study, which has 2 million different words, each with its etymology. That's what the human mind can do. It's unbelievable. I have it in my office, my study. This Oxford English Dictionary, 2 million different words, each with explanation where each word comes from. But the mind cannot know what is beyond what it learnt and what it can think about. The mind cannot know the source of itself. It cannot know the unlimited and the unconditioned. So it is up to us to go to the edge of the mind and jump off. Into an awareness that has no knowledge, but is endless knowing. We can use the mind to go beyond itself. For example, if we contemplate the word infinity. But after that, we need to live the mystery, not to try and understand it. So we'll take a minute now of quiet.